mystery.
Yes, thank you very much. First of all, let me thank the organizers very much for inviting me here. And yeah, so my talk pretty much connects to the two previous talks we had, discussing the sort of collisions, inelastic collisions in particular, between ions and ultra-cold atoms. There are two slight differences. First of all, I will mainly talk about physics on the level of single particles. And secondly, we're in the ultra-cold domain, so at nanokelvins of temperature, so way below the Doppler cooling limit. Oh, sorry. So maybe as a general introduction into atom-ion interactions, I know you had already two talks, but here's a very brief reminder of the mechanism, because the mechanism of how a single ion interacts with a neutral but polarizable atom can be understood in very simple terms. It's a simple electrostatic problem. If you put a single charge into a polarizable medium, then you will induce dipoles in the medium, and these dipoles, induced dipoles, they interact then again with the electric field of the charge. And since the dipole moment is proportional to the electric field itself via the polarizability, the local change of the electrostatic energy is just polarizability times the electric field of the charge squared. And this idea or this concept actually translates into the microscopic description of the interaction of the single ion with a neutral atom. So the ion polarizes the atom and gives rise to interaction potential, which to leading order is the polarizability of the neutral atom times the electric field of the ion squared. And so we are investigating the physics in this potential, and this potential is quite interesting as compared to the normal, in quotation marks, interaction potential, say, between two neutral atoms. Because first of all, it's much more long-ranged. It's 1 over r to the 4 as compared to the van der Waals interaction at 1 over r to the 6. And this gives rise, in principle, to many, many bound states up here in this potential. So the binding energy of the weakest bound states are very small because of the extended range of this potential. Moreover, the fact that this potential is quite far outreaching gives also rise to larger cross sections in collisions generally. We work with trapped systems, so both the atoms and the ions are trapped. We have single particle control over the ion and large trap depths, so we can hold on to the outcome products of the chemical reaction. And needless to say, there is a lot of work going on in that field. There's a whole bunch of theoretical work, probably left out a few contributors here unintentionally. And there's also a steadily growing experimental work in different regimes. You've already seen two talks. There will be one more. But there are also other groups exploring even slightly different regimes. OK, so the physics of the atom-ion collisions can be captured in this graph, sort of as a cartoon picture. This goes back to Vogt and Vanier from the 1950s. And what they basically considered was what kind of collisions does a neutral atom do with an ion that is localized here at the center. And what they figured is that in this 1 over r to the 4 potential, there is a critical impact parameter called VC here, which divides the potential problems into two classes. So if you're further out than this critical impact parameter, then essentially you have forward scattering. So you see that these blue trajectories are only very little deflected from the original trajectories. And this transfers very little momentum between the ion and the atom. If you're smaller than the, or have less impact parameter than this critical one, then you go into spiraling orbits around the scattering center here. And this is the famous Langevin process. So that's the process where the ion and the atom can actually come close enough to undergo a chemical process. And that is the process that we're mainly interested in for the inelastic processes. The other collisions out here, they're important for us because these elastic processes, they can lead to cooling between, or momentum exchange between the atom and the ion. as you will see in a minute. The total cross-section scales like 1 over energy to the 1/3 power. This was already worked out, I think. Well, this was worked out by these guys for sure, but I think it's already in the books of Landau. And the Langevin process is special, however, because the cross-section scales like 1 over square root of the energy, which means that the rate constant, which basically is velocity times cross-section, becomes energy independent. All right, this is the apparatus that we've been using now for the past 3 years to understand or to study the atom-ion reactions. Basically, it's a magnetic trap for the neutral atoms, where we prepare an ultra-cold cloud of atoms, roughly here, by evaporative cooling. So maybe a million atoms at 100 nanokelvins or so. And sandwiched between the magnetic traps, there is an ion trap, which is an RF pole trap, in which we trap a single ion or two ions or small crystals of ions, which you see up here. That's 9 ytterbium ions in an ion crystal. So we prepare these two systems independently of each other. And in the last moment before the interaction, we move the atoms into the trap through a bore in the sand cap electrode into the center of the ion trap. And there we have the choice of either leaving them magnetically trapped or to transferring them into an optical dipole trap of two cross beams. These are these red beams here. And in the dipole trap, we can actually trap any spin state of the neutral atoms. I should say that the systems that we're preparing here are very pure from the neutral atom point of view. So we typically prepare just one single Zeeman state of the atom. All right, so the first experiment that we did a few years back was simply to look at the elastic collisions between the atoms and the ion. And we observed the sympathetic cooling of the single ion when we immersed this into a Bose-Einstein condensate. This cooling process was relatively rapid, as you see here. And meanwhile, we have a much better estimate than this last data point here. So we know that this is now on the order of 20 millikelvins when we cool this down in contact with the Bose-Einstein condensate. We also could see the effect or the difference between the Langevin cross-section and the full elastic cross-section. So when we look now at the effect of the atoms, since they're at 100 nanokelvins of temperature, they're very sensitive to very small momentum exchanges with the ion. So momentum exchanges which are so small that you couldn't see it possibly on the ion. But on the atoms, we can. So we see a slight increase of their temperature, a slight energy intake from the forward scattering, and which gives rise to a significant enhancement of the temperature increase or the atom number loss as compared to just the Langevin cross-section. So this difference here is the difference between the semi-classical theory, including the quantum mechanical forward scattering, and the classical Langevin theory. OK, so but today we want to talk about inelastic collisions. And I will talk about three kinds of inelastic collisions. First of all, I will talk about charge exchange reactions when both the atom and the ions are in the ground state, electronic ground state. Secondly, I will talk about inelastic collisions when we put the ion into excited electronic states. And lastly, I will discuss inelastic collisions in the spin sector, so spin exchange and spin relaxation. So here's a quick overview over the level scheme. On the left, you see the ytterbium level scheme, where I've color marked the important energy states, which is the S1/2 ground state. So ytterbium plus has an alkali-like electronic configuration, one electron on top of a filled F shell in that case. So we have the S1/2 ground state, P1/2 excited state. And then there are two metastable D state and F state, which can be populated with laser light. And we are investigating the inelastic processes in all four of these states. The lifetime here is 50 milliseconds and a few years in that state. Rubidium has a very simple level structure, S1/2 ground state. This the state we're always working with. There's also the P state, which we use for detection of the rubidium, but that's not involved in any of the experiments. If we just look at the asymptotics of that ytterbium plus rubidium system, there are two channels that we can identify. First one is this channel, so the ytterbium plus rubidium, And there is the charge exchange channel, so where the electron has moved over from the rubidium to the terbium. And you see already here that this is energetically favorable by about 2 eV, simply because then the rubidium plus is in a noble gas configuration, and the terbium has 2 paired electrons in an S state. And what you see is when we start out asymptotically in this state, there's only one state below, which is this charge exchange channel. However, if we start out in the excited states, this can get quite messy. So there are many, many possible states where this can go into when undergoing a charge exchange. Generally, the energy scales that we're considering here, they stretch about 6 orders of magnitude. So with the electronic excitation energy here is on the order of a few electron volts. The trap depth, as I said earlier, it's relatively deep. It's 300 millielectron volts. So we can trap everything that has energy less than that. Then there is one important energy scale here, which is that this level is actually split by the hyperfine reaction. So there is a splitting of about 30 microeV. And the collision energies that I will be talking about are typically on the order of 3 microeV. So that's by far the lowest energy in the problem. There are actually also computations for how the energies look like when these two systems approach each other. However, these calculations are difficult for these many electron systems. And I will come back to that a bit later in the talk as well. So the way how we study the single ion chemistry is shown here. And this was also briefly discussed already in the previous talks. The situation is the following. We start out, say, with a 2-ion crystal in our trap. There's a Coulomb crystal of laser-cooled ions. And we overlap that with a neutral atom cloud. And then there are 4 possible outcomes. The boring outcome is this one. Nothing has happened. Then there are 2 different outcomes. You have to look closely for that. There are 2 different outcomes for an ion being left over. In one case, the ion has moved to the center position of the trap. In the other case, the ion is still bright but has not moved. In that case, we know that there is a dark ion next to it because we see the Coulomb repulsion between the 2 particles. Whereas in this case, we know that the other ion has been lost from the trap, or both have gone, which is very rare. OK, so the interesting case is this one here, where there is a dark partner left over. We want to find out what it is. For this, we employ this mass spectrometry technique. So essentially, we look for the collective mode of this 2-ion crystal. And this collective mode tells us about the mass of the unknown and invisible ion here. And so basically, we gently wiggle the crystal. And if we have 2 identical ions, so in that case, we typically get a resonance which looks like this. This is the fluorescent count. So if you hit the resonance, you heat the ions up, and the fluorescence goes down. And if there is a dark one here, for example, then the trace looks like this. So you see the shifted resonance. It's shifted up in frequency because in that case, the dark particle here was a rubidium plus, which is lighter, giving rise to higher frequency. I should say straight away, we have not seen a single molecule. We have had thousands of data runs. In all of the reactions we have seen, we have not seen a single molecule. We've only seen the creation of rubidium plus. So the different inelastic processes at the electronic level that we're interested in is charge exchange, as I said already earlier, as well as collisional quenching. So when we excite the ion to an higher lying electronic state, there's also the possibility that the high-lying electronic state is de-excited to the ground state, for example, in the collision with the rubidium, and this energy is then released. So in this case, we know that because the ion survived. There's no charge exchange. There's a bright ion being left over, and the ion is back in the S1/2 state. Okay, so we will look at these 2 processes here. So in the ground state, we just look at the charge exchange with the methods that I just explained. And since we're working with a single ion or 2 ions, we can actually tune the ion kinetic energy very precisely through the micromotion enhancement. So we apply a DC electric field, shift these ions out of the center portion of the trap, and depending by how much we shift them, we can tune their energy. So it's not an average energy here, but it's rather well controlled. and we look at the ion loss rate coefficients as a function of that energy, and indeed we find for both isotopes, 174 and 172, that the rate constant is energy independent. So this is really the Langevin process that we're seeing here. In terms of absolute numbers, this rate is rather small. So the Charlie change rate that we're seeing here is about 10 to the minus 5 of the calculated Langevin collision rate. So only in every 10 to the fifth approach of these two atoms coming close to each other, there's actually a charge exchange taking place, which is good for us because this means the system is fairly stable. And that's in the ground state. And now we will see how this is in the excited states. So we now populate the D state here and the F state here by optical pumping. So the F state is populated via this detour through the D5 half state, which decays into the F7 half state by emission of a photon. And the D3 half state is populated by pumping through the P1 half state. And this has, again, is metastable with tens of milliseconds of lifetime. So the interesting thing about these two states is we can prepare these states, then we can turn off the lights, and then we have collisions in excited states, but the light is off. So it's completely in the dark. That's unlike, say, for example, in neutral atom collisions, where usually the light is on during the collision because the lifetime of the excited state is too short for such an experiment to take place. This problem we have in the P1 half state. So the P1 half has a lifetime of a few nanoseconds. So this we can study only with the light field actually being on. So we prepare these states, and then we set up sort of a model which explains the ion loss rate or the inelastic collision rate in the following way. We take as a prefactor the Langevin rate constant here, and then we have the state occupation times a coefficient which we call the reactivity, even though some of the referees of the paper didn't like that expression, but I think it's quite intuitive what it means. The reactivity gives sort of the proportionality factor between the Langevin rate constant and the probability to make an inelastic process. And I said already, this number here for the ground state is on the order of 10 to the minus 5. And now by doing tons of measurements here, we can figure out the prefactors for the other states as well. And interestingly, for example, we find that for the D3 half states, this is unity. So when we go to the D3 half states, in every Langevin collision these two atom and the ion do, there is an inelastic process taking place. Interestingly, for example, in the F half state, it's much less frequent, it's on the order of 1%. And in the P1 half up here, it's on the order of 10%. So we have a huge variation of about 5 orders of magnitude between the reactivities for these 4 different states here. Now, this was all for the rubidium being in the stretched state. So in the state F equals 2, MF equals 2, where the nuclear spin and the electronic spin are aligned with each other. Now, we can also do these experiments in the absolute ground state of the rubidium, which is the F equals 1, MF equals 1. And our initial thought was that, well, if we go to the ground state, we can actually pluck a few of these collision channels, and the reactivity should go down. However, what we observed was that in the ground state here, the reactivity actually went up by about a factor of 30. So the charge exchange coefficient in the for the collisions between the ion with one or the other rubidium hyperfine ground state vary by a factor of 30, which is quite surprising given the energy scales that we're talking about here. In the D state, we did not see a significant change. However, of course, you cannot increase this above 1, obviously. Okay, so here's just sort of a few more data to firm up what we did. Here are the actual measurements of the state populations by detuning some of these lasers from resonance. It's a quite intricate method to actually determine these state occupations in this, well, actually it's a 5-level system with sufficient accuracy. The details you find in the manuscript. But essentially what you see from these two graphs is that the total inelastic collision rate follows closely the state population of the D3 half states. And this again reflects this fact that all the inelastic processes are completely dominated by the reactions in the D3 half state. So if we want to have a stable atom ion system between rubidium and ytterbium plus, we have to make sure that the D3 half state is not occupied. Okay, so here's the other effect, the collisional quenching. The collisional quenching we study from the F state. So we populate the state out here. I should say this is a relatively rare process. So we only had a few events out of a few thousand where we actually saw this quenching as nicely as here. So basically what we do is we prepare a two-ion crystal, pump both of the ions into the F state with optical pumping, put it into the neutral atom cloud, wait for 5 seconds, and then shine on this laser here, which probes the fluorescence on the S state. So when both of the ions are still in the F state, we see zero fluorescence. And after 6 seconds, we then do a repump pulse back into the S state to check that both the ions are still there. So that's sort of our reference measurement. Now, when you see the red curve, then here something happened in between. So during the interaction time between 1 and 5 seconds, one of the ions has been quenched from the F state to the S state because we see the fluorescence immediately when we turn on the detection laser light. But as I said, I mean, this process is really infrequent, and we had a few events out of a few thousand. Okay, so this was all I wanted to say about the reactions in the electronically excited states. Now let's come to something which is a little bit more subtle. That is the spin dynamics. And this is basically motivated by the following question. Spin 1/2 systems are sort of the most pristine quantum mechanical objects that we have. And if we prepare them in perfect isolation from an environment, we know exactly what they do. And even if we have many of them, say in such an ion crystal here, we know what they do. We can use them for quantum computing. We can use them for quantum simulation. But for small systems, we can pretty much predict how the dynamics is. Now, this all gets a little bit more tricky when these spin 1/2 systems are interacting with an environment. So this is something that you would encounter, for example, if you do quantum information processing in a solid state host material, where, say, an NV center can interact with nuclear spins around it or other similar effects or in semiconductors. So when we add particles around that, then the coherence of these objects is not conserved very well, and particularly not for very long. But we have to understand this decoherence when we have spin systems in environments. And this is what we're now going to do. So we're going to look into the spin physics of the ion when it's immersed into such a spin polarized neutral atom bath. So that's sort of the cartoon picture. We have the ion. We have all the other atoms around being spin polarized. And then the ion can interact with the atomic spin. That's sort of one of the classic paradigms of studying decoherence, the spin 1/2 coupled to an environment. So far in the cold, or generally in the atomic physics context, this has been the decoherence has been mostly looked at in the context of spontaneous emission. But here we now have the opportunity to actually explore this in a bath of other atoms in a very well-controlled setting. And there are a number of specific atom ion questions that we're interested in. First of all, we have to find out how strong is the coupling between the two, what's the nature of the coupling, is it spin exchange, spin relaxation, and does it lead to decoherence? There are, of course, some toy models around for studying spin 1/2s in environments. And over the many years, basically two different toy models have emerged to describe two different physical settings. One, which goes back to Caldera and Leggett, and maybe even earlier to Feynman, is the question, what happens to a spin 1/2 when you put it into a bath which consists of harmonic oscillator modes? This is, for example, an atom coupled to the quantum vacuum, or this is coupling to photons to phonons in a solid state or electrons. So basically, we have a bath here which has a continuous spectrum and a set of harmonic oscillator bosonic modes. So this is often called the spin boson problem. The other bath that people have looked at as a model system is the spin bath, which is basically, or the central spin problem, where you have a single spin surrounded by other spins. These spins are localized, but they can flip up or down on their location. So they have a discrete spectrum. And this gives rise to completely different physics in that setting. So in our case, we somehow realize a combination of these two, because we have the spins. They can flip up and down, the spins of the atoms, but they're also free to move. So they also have a continuous spectrum. And so we're not realizing any of these in its precise sense, but it's a combination of the two. So the spin-spin interaction that can take place in this system, first of all, could be spin exchange. Spin exchange is relatively simple to understand. You have a spin of the ion, a spin of the atom. If they're not parallel to each other and they collide, what can happen is that these two spins rotate about the axis that defines the sum of the two spins. That's a spin-conserving process, but there is transfer of spin from one to the other. This has the interesting property that if you have particles in stretched spin states and they collide, this must be preserved, right? Because here the sum of the spins is parallel to the spins themselves. If you have the other hand, if you have spin relaxation, you somehow must break the symmetry that conserves the spin. And this can be, for example, in spin orbit coupling, if you have anisotropic coupling. And this can actually lead to the relaxation of spin stretched states as well. And what we're used to in atomic physics usually is that spin exchange is much, much larger than spin relaxation. And not only at cold temperatures, but also at hot temperatures, for example, when you look at the optical pumping of helium-3. OK, so what are our spin 1/2 systems? We have two choices. We can either use the Zeeman ground state in 174 ytterbium plus, which has exactly two states. That's a perfect spin 1/2 system. It's a bit hard to detect, so we do this by shelving into the F7.5 state for the experts. Or we use the hyperfine qubit in 171 ytterbium plus, which is nice because it's magnetic field insensitive. It connects two MF equals zero states. However, the full system is a four-level system, and you will see actually in a minute that this makes a difference. Okay, our spin polarized environment is still the rubidium-87. We can prepare any of these states either in an optical trap or those which are magnetically trappable in a magnetic trap. So here are the data. We look first at the Zeeman qubit and measure the longitudinal coherence, or the T1 time. So we prepare the ytterbium either in the ground state or in the excited state, immerse it into the rubidium. The rubidium is prepared in the ground state to start with, and then we read out the population of the excited ytterbium state. And what we see is the following. When we start in the ground state, population comes up to about 60%. If we start in the excited state, population goes down to about 60% on the time scale, which is given by a few Langevin collision times. So this directly shows that we have a spin-spin coupling between the ytterbium and the rubidium. And the strength is relatively strong because this happens on the time scale of a few Langevin times. Now, in here, the rubidium is not protected against spin exchange because this is not a spin-stretched state. The question now is what happens when we go to the spin-stretched state of the rubidium, combine this with the spin-stretched state of the ytterbium, is the system then stable? So do we see mainly spin exchange, or is there a lot of spin relaxation in the problem? And what we see is the following. We see that even this state, which is protected from spin exchange, decays again to roughly 60%. Occupation, and the state which is down here comes up. So basically, we see that we have a very strong spin relaxation in the problem, which is actually equal or even larger than the spin exchange rate for the collisions between the ytterbium plus and the neutral rubidium. OK, so we can then play the same trick also for the hyperfine states. So we can prepare either of the hyperfine states here, and then we see that we can either get a relaxation down here when we use the rubidium in that state, or in the stretched state of the rubidium, we relax again not to zero, but to a finite value here. So for the hyperfine state, we actually have a model for that, which could help explaining this a little bit. And the model is roughly the following. If we assign this spin here a temperature by knowing sort of the difference in energy between these two states, then we can say, OK, the spin temperature that we're having here is about 200 millikelvins. Now, what can happen now in this process is that there is energy release from this state up here. The hyperfine energy release of the rubidium can take place. And this can be converted into translational kinetic energy. And if we sort of set up a simple model for that, that we say, OK, we have heat intake from the release of hyperfine energy of the rubidium and balance this with the cooling that we have from the elastic collisions with the other rubidiums which are around that, then we will find that in equilibrium we have a translational temperature of about 240 millikelvin. So it seems to suggest that we have somehow an equilibration between the kinetic temperatures and the spin temperatures of the ion. Okay, so my last slide. I will show you one more thing here. That is, I said, okay, there is a difference that we actually have a four-level system. And because what we then did was we resolved what is actually happening really in that process when the spin decays from this state up here. So the measurements before, they were integrated over all the excited states, alpha, beta, and gamma. But now we are actually able to resolve these spin states individually. And what we see is the following. So when we look just at the decay of the beta state, then you see that it's almost a double exponential. There's a very fast decay in the beginning and then a slower decay towards the end. And this fast decay in the beginning of the population of the beta state is actually the buildup of population in the alpha and in the gamma states, which you see here and here. So that there's a very fast transfer of spin from beta to alpha and gamma, and then slowly all of them decay down to the F equals zero ground state. And again, the transfer from here to there would be forbidden by spin exchange. So this is pure spin relaxation. However, they seem to be equally strong as the population of the alpha state, which is possible by spin exchange. All right, so our chairman is getting nervous. OK, so I can offer you one possible explanation, which actually involves our chairman. So maybe he's a bit mild. So this is a bit puzzling for us, why there is so much spin relaxation. And we've been in discussion with Olivier and with Alexei Bukharenko in Moscow about that. And they made some suggestion what could be the reason. And this is still very preliminary, because you see there are two different theory curves, one from Olivier and one from Alexei. They don't agree yet perfectly with each other for several reasons. But basically, one approach and explanation could be, we're entering in this channel here, which is the rubidium electronic ground state and the ytterbium plus electronic ground state. And we're looking for a mechanism to do a charge exchange, with spin orbit coupling. And one possibility could be that there is actually here a resonance to this blue channel or cyan channel. And this could provide a matrix element for spin orbit coupling. At the moment, the calculations are not yet quite there to tell whether this is actually at zero energy or slightly above or slightly below. So at the moment, we cannot really say. But this could be one possibility to help explaining the results that we see. OK, so with this, I stop. And I thank you for your attention.
OK, so thank you very much for this nice talk. And you understood that you can thank your colleagues or you can pay the chairman, right? So OK, so Roger.
As possible. Sure. Michael, in the beginning of your talk, you showed us formulas and collisional cross-section, which for me looked like classical or quasi-classical cross-section. Is it such that interactions and collisions of these ions in an ultra-cold gas, they are described by a classical regime or quasi-classical? What are the energies?
Yes, so we're in the semi-classical regime. We have about 20 partial waves.
Sorry?
We have about 20 partial waves, roughly, in terms of energy. So it's semi-classical.
And which temperatures are there in this experiment with these collisions?
In the low millikelvin. So if we're as I just said, so when we're in the with the rubidium in the excited state, we're at 200 millikelvin. If we're with the rubidium in the ground state, we're probably in the 10 millikelvin.
Then for rubidium, it's clear.
Yeah. So the closest to Cartesian
issue for me. Just on this model that you had there, so what do you define as a spin temperature? So you prepare pure spin states, right, at the beginning?
Well, this is not a pure spin state anymore. From this graph, you can't know, but there is one I didn't show you. Here we did actually Ramsey spectroscopy on these states, and we can actually measure the T2 time. So we can actually measure that it decays to a mixed state and not just a rotated spin state.
I see.
So that's an important information that I didn't give you. But sort of we can conclude that this is really a dephase state. So we have two populations, ground state, excited state, mm-hmm. and from this ratio we define the spin temperature.
Mm-hmm. I got a question about the charge exchange experiment. So you write the total reaction rate as a simple sum of different channels. I was wondering if it's possible for the different channels to interfere.
In principle, yes, I would say. In our experiment, we did not see any indication for that. So we're preparing. Let me go back. So, for example, in this graph, this is prepared, sort of these mixtures of states are prepared with near resonant light. These are really just the population. But we think it's not that we create coherent superpositions between the different states. So that's why we made also the incoherent model for the rates. The only time where we actually study what happens to coherence superposition between the states is for the spins, but we haven't done that for the charge exchange yet. So there are no many body effects here.
Yes. Well, actually, I'm going to ask you about the reservoir that you use when you talk about your temperature, et cetera. So there's this kind of theme or movement within electromechanical systems, including optomechanics, to engineer the reservoir and produce non-thermal reservoirs. And I wonder to what extent here it's possible for you to produce non-thermal reservoirs to control sort of the density matrix associated with the reservoir itself.
So the reservoir that we're having here essentially is classical, right? It's a thermal gas. It's not Bose condensed. It's a thermal gas where the particles are practically uncorrelated. If we would go to a Bose gas or a Mott insulator or something like that, then one could envisage studying that.
Yeah, because it's often stated as a sort of a complementarity, or if you wish, weak point of quantum gases, that they're isolated, and you can't engineer reservoirs, whereas in electromechanical systems you can. In fact, that's very easy to do.
Yes.
And so I wonder if here this might be a real strength of quantum gases that you're bringing out if you were to move in that direction.
One could possibly. I mean, for example, there were these recent experiments by Emmanuel Bloch where, through some clever manipulation in the optical lattice, he could produce a system which had negative temperatures, negative absolute temperatures. Now, you can believe in negative temperatures or not, whatever, but putting the ion into such a system would be such an engineered reservoir in that sense, where you have a spectrum which is bound from above and not bound from below.
I believe in negative temperatures. I wrote the commentary on that paper. Yes, it's quite valid. So that's an interesting idea. Thank you.
I had a question myself. I mean, because you've shown this extremely diverse magnitude for the rate constants depending on the excited state of ytterbium, I was wondering maybe in the same spirit that Stefan showed for N2 plus rubidium, where he was addressing this coincidence between the levels between of rubidium N2 plus and N2. So I was wondering, I suppose that you have checked that, of course, with all these many levels of ytterbium plus and ytterbium.
I can tell you for the asymptotic channels.
Yeah, sure,
there
sure.
There we know.
From that point of view, yes.
There, the situation is actually opposite. Mm-hmm. So when you look fairly closely here, the red state in the star exchange channel has a gap on the other side, which is the one that is short-lived.
Yeah.
And the green state has states which are very nearby.
Okay.
So this cannot provide the explanation.
Okay.
It's completely the opposite.
Yeah. All right. Stefan.
So I have a comment on this, actually. I mean, this is one can't really make this comparison, right? Because N2 plus is a molecular system, right, which has many different vibronic levels. Yeah, and they, of course, also play an important role here, right? Whereas those are completely lacking in these the yeah. atomic system that we are studying here. Yeah, but
it was not so yeah. clear. If you have a real coincidence between yeah. two atomic levels, of course you don't have this diversity of levels, but still they're quite dense in terms of, you know. Yeah. Other questions?
Okay, if not, let's thank.
I'll speak to you again.
And let's proceed to the last talk of the session, which is, will be given by Johannes Denschlag, and actually we will then complete, I suspect, the tour of iron neutral chemistry, because now we are going to three-body systems after having, let's say, some kind of many-body systems and two-body systems, so let's stay in between now.